You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no.
I think that was for some movie, for God's sakes. The let me see if I can.
I'm not sure about that, but I know it was a.
Go ahead, Tony.
I know it was our period song.
Okay, let me find a better version. So hold on.
I wrote my mother. I wrote my father. And now I'm writing you too. I'm sure of mother. I'm sure of father. And now I wanna be sure, very, very sure of you. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
Now, I don't use that song very much, but my guest today is Tony Kappa, and he said that was pretty much the song of the day when he joined the Marine Corps. And so joining us is a veteran of a Marine who's a native of San Clemente, not a native, but he resides in San Clemente, California. And he fought on Iwo Jima, and through the wonders of Larry Reynolds, he kind of introduced us. And so joining me today is Tony Kappa. Tony, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio, and thank you very much for doing this.
Happy to be here with you. You bet, Mike.
Okay. The first question, born and raised where?
Inglewood, California. That's LAX area.
Oh, you're a native guy. How about that? So tell me about that. I mean, if you were, were you born in Inglewood?
I was born in 426 West Linden Street in Inglewood, California. It was a residence. My mom was a nurse, and we did a home delivery.
Wow. And so when did your parents come to the state?
They came here. My dad was born in Naples, Italy, and came here when he was 6 years old, I think, maybe a little younger than that. And my mom came over as an adult from London, England, and became an RN. And she was working in the Brooklyn Navy Hospital, and my dad was working in the shipyards during World War I. And he lost two fingers on a press that broke and repeated and came down when it shouldn't. So they met in the Brooklyn Navy Hospital as things happened, and fell in love and had a daughter, my sister, and came to California. He thought the family wouldn't like him marrying a girl that wasn't a nice Italian girl, so he packed up and came west.
Really? And so what did so you guys settled in Inglewood back in the day when kind of Inglewood was what, in South Los Angeles, right? And there was a whole lot of farmland south of Inglewood. What did your dad stay in the shipbuilding business? Your mom, she was a nurse?
My dad, Kappa business in Italy was upholstery and drape hanging and things like that. And dad was an upholsterer and whatnot, but they didn't have too much work for the upholsterers when he first came. And so he went to work for a furniture manufacturer. He built heavy classic furniture for the rich people's homes, and dad drove the truck and delivered, and sister and I used to be in the back of the truck up in all of the blankets that protect the wood, and we had a good time. It was a nice period of our lives.
You know, they don't let people do that anymore. You know that, don't you? You can't ride.
Especially without a seatbelt.
You can't ride in the back of the truck. Yeah, you can't ride without a seatbelt, let alone the. You tell kids that, they're like, what? They did what? Yeah. Don't worry about it. Wow. Where'd you go to high school?
Inglewood High School. We were the. Our nickname or whatever was the Inglewood Sentinels, like Indian Sentinel. And that was our name for the people. We were Sentinels. Inglewood Sentinels, the ones that went to high school there.
There you go. And your mom continued her career as a nurse when she came out? Huh?
No. In those days, mothers stayed home and worked. You know, through the Depression, they even passed it. I don't know if they got passed or not. They tried to pass a law that women couldn't work, that they wanted to keep the women home and let the men have the jobs. A little different than today, right?
A little bit, a little bit, yeah. No, it's jaw-dropping to young people when they think about that. But I grew up in pretty much the same culture where, you know, it wasn't a day I ever came home from school that my mom wasn't there waiting for me. And I changed my clothes and got the hell out of there. I didn't need her in my life that much. How does the Marine Corps? So what year were you born?
1922. February 7th.
Okay, so February 7th. Well, happy birthday, right? You're how old are you now?
I'm 97, and on the 7th of February I'll be 98.
Wow. So what do you attribute to your longevity to? What's the secret?
It's not clean living, I can tell you that.
That's awesome.
I don't know. They say the Mediterranean diet, which would be my dad's...
Native diet.
Native food is a good diet. And, of course, we ate Italian food quite often. And Mom always believed in natural. There was... A naturalist on the radio in those days, and he George Bernard Shaw,
right?
And he proclaimed the necessity of eating as natural as possible. So Mom followed some of those rules. I think as her background as a nurse and so on and so forth. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Well, congratulations. Talk to me about how does the Marine Corps get on your radar? You're what, 18 in 1940, so you're just about to turn 19 in 1941 on December 7th. So you were already out of high school, I take it.
I was, yeah. I got out of high school, and at that time we were doing a lend-lease thing with England on our war machines, and we were making airplanes and shipping them over. And I went to work for Douglas Aircraft out of high school and worked at a fabrication where they laid the aluminum sidings or what fuselage on a flat table, and you'd go around with a key punch was something else, but anyway, it was an arm with a drill on it, and you'd move around on a template and pop the drill down in different little areas for the rivets on the machine. Well, that was Douglas, and most of my friends had gone, so it was time for me to volunteer, which I did, and thinking I could be some work on the planes and an aircraft carrier. So I volunteered for the Navy, got up into a Chester Williams building downtown L.A. where they was the first step, and they called off half a dozen names or so and told us to go stand in a different area, and we did, of course. And you guys are Marines. Okay.
Wait a minute. What? How did that happen? They just walked in and said, all you guys are Marines now?
Yeah, well, they called off the names and told us to go stand in an area. Well, you know, that was 43.
Uh-oh.
And in 1943, we were running out of gunfodder. So when I went into the Marines, there were men 30, 35 years old, a few, and one of them happened to work in the shipyards with my dad prior to going, I guess he was drafted into the Marines, and the rest of them were high school kids, just graduated.
So
just 18 years old. I was an older man to all of those youngsters.
And you were what, 22, 23?
Yeah, I was 21, I think.
21. The and so you what in 1943? What month do you enlist?
It was wow. Well, it must have been January or the last of 42 because. Well, that's when it was. I'm sure.
All right. So where do you go to? Obviously, MCRD and then Camp Elliott. And so, talk to us about recruit training. What was that like?
It was okay. We San Diego boot camp, and drilling and hygiene and all the good stuff. Got all the shots. I remember standing on a parade field. They marched us out to the parade field after I got some shots one day, and I was standing there and starting to feel faint. And I told the DI, I said, "I'm not feeling good." He said, "Well, go back in, lay down, and you're okay." And I was okay, but I'm sure I had a missile dinner that night. But anyway, I remember that quite well. We were standing in the hot sun, and hit me. Other than that, marching to the mess hall was always a challenge. There were guys right beside where we marched in, scraping trays and doing KP. "You'll be sorry, sucker," and he yells out things, just to make you feel good.
That's great. How was the food? Was the food any good?
It was good, sure.
Oh, wow, that's good.
I think that's right. First had SOS in boot camp, and then, of course, many times after that. You know SOS, I'm sure.
Yeah, shit on a shingle. So yeah. What is that? That's military talk for what? Beef and gravy? Biscuits and gravy? If civilized people would call it that, yes?
Right. Yeah. In fact, I had biscuits and gravy, SOS, so to speak, this morning for breakfast at
Get out.
What's your name? Anels. Yeah, I get stuck on names. Anyway, and you'll be meeting Adele one of these days when you come here because it's one of Larry's favorite places, and his wife, they stopped there, and I've just been reintroduced. She's been in town a long time.
Adele, what's the name of her restaurant? Adele?
Adele's.
Adele's Restaurant.
Yeah, and she's in, it used to be, it still is, I think, called the San Clemente Inn, isn't it? Yeah. It's in the San Clemente Inn, it was like a hotel when you were around, I bet.
I'm taking my two daughters to Sonny's tonight to have a little lasagna, so.
You might see my grandson if you see a 6-foot Caucasian. Mm-hmm. About 21 years old, and his name's Gavin. He's my grandson. My great-grandson, actually.
Does he work at Sonny's?
Yeah.
All right. I'll look for Gavin. 6 foot.
Yeah. All right. Are you in town now?
Oh, no. I'm just up the 405 in Costa Mesa, so up by Newport Beach.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
sure.
So I'm a stone's throw from you. So I got to talking about Italian food, and somebody brought Sonny's up, and I have good memories of eating lasagna at Sonny's with with that nice hot bubbling still coming when they deliver, the lasagna to your table. So I kind of got a little hankering for that.
I hope it fulfills your wishes.
Well, so do I. You're Italian, though. What's your favorite Italian dish?
I don't know. I like pasta fazool, and that's a macaroni with beans, and they make a pizzelle also, which is with peas. No tomato.
No tomatoes? You're Italian, though. What the hell?
Yeah.
Go figure, Go figure. Yeah. All right. Talk to us about – so you get through recruit training, and then where do you go? What do you become?
I became the best Marine I could, of course. Got to hold up the name, family name. Anyway, from boot camp, I think we went to Pendleton. We did our rifle training at Pendleton, and we did our marching and so on and so forth. And then next thing I know, we're the 4th Marine Division, which I joined, was the 1st Marine Division to go right into combat. I wasn't with them. They went to the Marianas first.
Right.
And our home base on Maui, up on the slopes of Haleakala, was also the base for the 5th Amphib Corps. Anyway, we went to Maui, up on the slopes of Haleakala, and did our marching around there to stay in shape. After all our training at boot camp in Pendleton, we'd march through the on the roads, but through the fields of pineapples, and the natives there that were picking pineapples and whatnot would throw us one to eat as we walked, as we marched. We didn't march to a cadence, but we right. stayed in line and stayed in formation. And
Tony, now were you in, were you an 0311? Were you a machine gunner? Were you a mortarman? What'd you do? What was your job in the division when you got to Hawaii?
Yeah, at that time I was just a rifleman, and I got my PFC promotion from private, and so I was with the 23rd Regiment. I don't remember the number of our platoon. I think it was B Company. So, and that was the home base, I mentioned that, of the 4th Marine Division on Maui. It's right by, there's a little popular town there called Haiku, if you've ever been on Maui. It's up on top. It's just a few miles away from the camp, which is now up. It turned into a park. They pushed all the, from what a man that lives on the island, I talked to him when I went to visit one time, and he said they pushed all the Quonset huts and so on and so forth, at telephone wires and so on, so the camp existed, into the canyons and covered them up. Anyway, they have a park there now, and it's Camp Maui, and they raised the they have a Marine flag and a American flag and a Hawaiian flag flying on the on a monument there that refers to the 4th Marine Division.
What's your fondest memory of your time in Hawaii? Now, so you get there in sometime in 1943. Does the 4th Division fight in a battle before Iwo Jima?
Yes, they had. They were the first ones to leave the States, and they were Tinian, Saipan. I don't think they did Saipan. Tinian and a couple of the other Mariana Islands there they did, and then came to Maui.
And then from Maui, you guys head to Iwo Jima, or is there another fight before Iwo Jima?
No, it was for me and for them also, for the whole division. After the Marianas, why they came back to Maui, regrouped, and that's where I came in. I was in with a rifle company, infantry, and we did our. I went to the butts to do our keep our sharpshooting going, and so on and so forth. It was a beautiful area, you know, Maui, and where we went, there was a waterfall and a pool, and we could go skinny dipping there, and so on and so forth. And there was, if you missed the target, you shot out over the sea, but I don't think too many missed, because the target's put onto a bunch of hay straw or whatever, and you had to be a pretty poor shot not to at least hit the hay, you know.
Had you done any prior to your time in the Marine Corps? Had you done any hunting or shooting?
No. Well, baby gun, and that sort of thing as a youth. But no, not. Or maybe a .22. We used to go rabbit hunting right up where LAX is now. And you know, Inglewood is now hosting the Chargers and the
right.
Yeah, and San Diego.
Yeah, your hometown is going to be big stuff. Not just
Rams and the Chargers. Yeah, and that whole area, that was Hollywood Park prior to the
right.
taking it down. But that was all acreage, and the Japanese people farmed mostly turnips there.
Wow.
And in the early days, the 20s and the 30s, and then Hollywood Park came, and then the Forum down a little bit north of the park. And we used to, there was a little creek that ran down from a golf course through there, and we used to go crawdad fishing with piece of bread tied to a piece of string, and the crawdads would grab it and we'd yank them out of the water.
How funny. You know, people.
Yeah, just fun.
People would look at the map of Los Angeles today and hear that story and say, are you kidding me? That Inglewood was farmland?
Yeah.
And they would just look at you like, that's unbelievable. I can't even believe that.
Yeah.
But, when I first came out here, you know, the helicopter base in Tustin, that was all by itself. El Toro was all by itself, and you had a small enclave of homes in Mission Viejo. Irvine wasn't there. Newport Beach was, and then Laguna was its own separate little enclave. And then you have the separate little towns of San Juan Capistrano and Dana Point. And then you had more, you know, space. And then you had San Clemente. And then you had the base. But, you know, now what is one urban mess between Camp Pendleton and Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, you know, didn't used to be like that. And so when you hear people talk about that, you know, I know people that are younger look and say, that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is, of course.
Let's talk about, so you guys get on ships, and what had you been told, Tony, about the fight, or did you not really get told anything about it until you got on ship?
That's true. We didn't know where we were going, but some of us, the guys that were a little smarter than me, I think, kind of felt that we were going to Iwo Jima. They must have been heard something or picked up something somewhere. And other than that, but otherwise, I really didn't know. It took us almost a month to get there from Maui. By the way, because of the submarine scares and so on and so forth, they took devious routes to get from one place to another. And, of course, I guess there was destroyers and whatnot probably following us, but I didn't see them.
Give me an example of what was the day like, and what kind of ship were you on?
It was they called an APA. It was the one they were building to transport troops on and materials and so on and so forth, but it was a little spooky. They had us stacked up about, I guess, maybe 8 high down in the bowels of the ship on bunks, of course, that were constructed. And you couldn't help but think, well, if a torpedo hit or if we got into trouble. Well, they did. In fact, there was a submarine scare, and they battened down the hatch. And all the troops were down below, you know, and it can get a little spooky if torpedo was hit. Well, they'd just keep the hatch button up, of course, and the ship would do its best to sail on. But anyway, it was an interesting trip. And Anna Wetok, I found a piece of line, and we were anchored off of Anna Wetok for a couple of 3 days on our way to Iwo, and they had me doing fire watch down in the holds of the ship. And it was a watch. You'd spend so many hours there just sitting on top of sea bags or whatever. But I found a line and a hook, I guess. Anyway, I dropped it over the side of the ship one day and caught a fish. And it was a ugliest thing I ever saw. It had protruding teeth. I learned later the name of it, and I know it well, but I can't come up with it right now. But it was part of our trip from Maui to Iwo Jima.
Did you eat it?
Yeah, I didn't eat it. No, I tossed it back.
It's too ugly to eat?
Well, it really wasn't that. They just they had no place to cook it, you know.
If I'd taken it
to the mess hall, they might have.
What's your first recollection as you closed on Iwo Jima? What's your first recollection of seeing the island or hearing the gunfire? What was your first?
One of my early impressions was the Japs are never going to win this war because why was my thought in that direction?
Yeah,
there were so many ships anchored off of the island. And the destroyers were running right up to Sarabachi. It seemed like they were right next to it, but it looked like they were almost on it, firing into Sarabachi with their guns and so on and so forth. And I remember I guess they were probably machine gun bullets or something falling on the decks and making a little click, click. But I don't recall anybody getting hurt by a falling bullet, so they must have been quite spent and not too. I don't know if anybody ever, if they dropped on somebody or not. They didn't drop on me, I know that, but I remember hearing them. I didn't know what it was at first, and I figured it out.
What was it like to watch the obviously the bombardment and the preparation? Were you in a position to watch that? Were you guys over the horizon?
I went in on the second day, by the way. So I wasn't near Suripachi. We went down. I think they called it Orange Beach 2 or something, but it was by what they call the second airstrip. I refer to it and. Right. We were pinned down at that time, but one of my strong recollections is seeing the first flag go up on Suripachi, and I think that was the third day.
Right.
Third, fourth day. And then it went down, and I thought, oh, shit, they recaptured the high ground. But no, and a few minutes later, up comes the big flag.
Oh, so you remember seeing that?
I do, yeah. We were on the beach yet. We hadn't gone, and we were, like I said, down below that airstrip. Right. On the sand. You know the sand on...
You bet. Just for everybody, when this, as you're listening to this, if you click on the post, you'll see maps of where the 23rd Marines landed, and there's a map that shows where 1st Battalion, 23rd Marines landed, and so you can see that... You know, you had the 5th Marine Division on the left, and the 5th Marine Division, one of their tasks was to go up and do what they did on Mount Suribachi. The 4th Marine Division would wheel right and head towards Airfield Number 2, and there's names like the Rock Quarry, the Amphitheater, the Turkey Knob, the Meat Grinder. All of those are synonymous with the 4th Marine Division as they wheeled right and essentially headed north. Off the beach, and that was the 23rd Marines, the 24th Marines, and the 25th Marine Regiments. And that was, as everybody knows who follows the battle, that was not for the faint of heart, the fighting that went on in that part of the island. Your first recollection, so you come ashore, Tony, and what do you see your first time in combat, and what the hell goes through your head?
Well, it was my first time in combat, and there wasn't any combat going on at that particular moment. And, you know, you think of combat as maybe a firefight and things of that sort, which, of course, were taking place on Suribachi. That's where all the action, heavy action, was, of course. And so, yeah, I was just there. There were no guns going off near me, and... on the beach there, and you know, the sand was warm because of the sulfur in it, I understand, and grainy, it was different. But we were there, I think we were on the beach a day and a half or 2 days, and they put me with a machine gun group, and they were new to me, and I didn't know a damn thing about a machine gun, really. But I don't think I fired one in our training. So I was like, but they had a sergeant and they had a couple of gunners and I think one other person. So I became I came with them and I carried the ammunition, 2 cans of 30 caliber machine gun ammunition.
So for those of for people that aren't familiar, so machine guns at that time, the 30 caliber, that was the one with the single handle on the back, Tony?
Yeah, well, you had the heavy water-cooled gun from that when we would stop our advance and go dig in for the night and so on and so forth. We'd set up the heavy, but in the daytime it was the light machine gun with the handle and so on. They're both the same, I think, the way I remember.
Okay, the same caliber. Okay, one was a water cooled one that we see, and one was kind of had the vented barrel, air cooled, right?
Yes, the air cooled, and that would be, we'd carry that in the daytime, and then we'd go back for the heavy at night.
All right. Yeah. So you first get ashore, and what's your first recollection of the first contact you make now that you're part of a machine gun squad?
Yeah. Well, part of the machine gun squad, that was fine. You know, you take what you get.
Right.
It was a sergeant and then a number one and number two gunner and so on and so forth. Well, we advanced up and over and across the airstrip and on our way. And I remember seeing some of the places where the Japs had camped, more or less. They left teacups and little stoves and stuff along behind and so on and so forth. And there were dead Japanese as we progressed. And the first obstacle that we did was the amphitheater that you mentioned earlier as one of the fights that we encountered. And that, for me, was not rifle combat. I was with the machine gun group, and of course I carried the ammunition. It's interesting carrying the ammunition because you got your carbine slung over your shoulder and it keeps slipping off and so on and so forth. Anyway, the amphitheater, which we had set up the heavy gun to do overhead fire for the troops as they advanced.
Right.
I saw my friends from Camp Maui and whatnot going by and whatnot, and we were firing overhead. A sniper got my sergeant first, didn't knock him down, but he wounded him, so he went back to the back lines. Then we had the number one gunner and the same sniper, I guess, I'm sure it was, took our number one gunner. Number two took over. Sniper got him, and I was standing there. There was a little stone building. It looked like a water well thing or something. I don't remember. But I looked up, and I saw this machine. I saw this rifle barrel sticking out of the bushes. And I don't know if I had buck fever or what, but we had stacked our rifles. You kind of lock them together. And before I got my thing unlocked, I was looking up at this, and I saw him pull his rifle back out, and I saw his head move. He had, just like in the movies, he had similar leaves to the bushes that were around him, stuck in his helmet. It must have been stuck in his helmet. I didn't see his face, and I didn't see his helmet, but I saw the things that were stuck into his helmet moving. So he just snuck off and never got a shot at him or anything.
We
stopped firing then, and the next thing you know, the troops are coming back. They withdrew. You know, the Marines like to say a ready grave movement.
Well, I'll tell you what. One of the things that I've done, because Iwo Jima to me was a fascinating battle, because you know the island's still, you know, a lot the way it was, and when you look at the battle, it's just, you know, it's just such an iconic fight, and it's kind of been a hobby for me. But when you follow the progress of the 4th Marine Division on the right flank, they land and they wheel to the right, and you know, you measure their progress every day in feet, right? You know, the 5th Marine Division gets Suribachi and then moves across the island. The 4th Marine Division, they sit and they slug it out with the Japanese that are in those places. I mean, the meat grinder got its name, right? Very appropriately, right? Turkey Knob. But it's all this honeycombed, you know, deep in the ground Japanese, you know, mutually supporting positions. And when you follow them, and if you follow the progress day by day, and there was a series of books that the Marine Corps put out years ago, and they're colored maps, and they follow the progress of the fight by day. And so what you see is you see the color moving, you know, across the island, and it moves very, very slowly up the right side of the island. And that's the progress of the 4th Marine Division and in the places that you're talking about. So those retrograde movements, you know, happen what, Tony, on a daily basis, where the prep would go, the machine guns would lay on those targets, and then the grunts would go, and then the grunts would ultimately pull back because you know they couldn't make the ground and they couldn't hold the ground, and they did that on a daily basis. So the 4th Marine Division fight, very, very interesting on a daily basis because of how well dug in and well prepared the Japanese were in that part of the island.
Yeah, well, that amphitheater I didn't know what actually happened in the basic amphitheater, because, like I said, we gave overhead fire, and the troops marched past us going in, and they marched past us going coming back out. But later on, in fact, just a year or two ago, I met a Marine that was a lifer Marine. He spent his life there, and he knew he was on Iwo Jima, and he knew about what was going on better than I did. And I asked him, I said, what happened in the amphitheater? We pulled out of there, and he said, well, the next day we sent a couple of tanks in and burned them out. So that they were probably mostly in dug in into the caves, as we know. And like I said, two tanks went in and cleaned them out, where our division or our whoever it was, or if it wasn't the whole division, it was in the amphitheater. But anyway, they couldn't do it, but the tanks went in and cleaned it out.
Yeah, you know, I read an account of that where they said it was gruesome work, as the armored bulldozers would bulldoze a road, and the Marines, you know, were around, you know, providing security and to get a road built so that the flame tanks in particular could come in there and burn them out of there. They said it was pretty gruesome stuff, but those flame tanks obviously worth every penny that got spent on them. And but again, the nature of the close fight that you and your guys were in. So what happens to you? So everybody in your your machine gun team is killed or wounded. Do you become the leader of the team? What happens to you after that?
No, we weren't firing at that time because they were troops who were coming back past us, and the paramedics came and took the two. They weren't wounded, they were dead. They got it in the head, both of them. The sergeant, he got it in the body somewhere because he walked him way back. But, I was just another Marine. The only heroic thing I ever did, and it wasn't very heroic, we went back to the second line of defense, and we had left a tripod of the heavy gun where we were firing from, so nobody wanted to go pick it up, but I volunteered to go. I didn't volunteer. I just went. I went and picked up the tripod for the heavy gun and brought it back. So that was about it. I had another. Well, if you want to hear another death story, there was we were dug in one night in our. They called it a Nemor, I guess it was fired, and it came up and hit right by where the machine gun tripod was, where we're going to set up. The gun wasn't on it at the time, but the tripod was there. Anyway, it came up and exploded right there. Didn't do any hurt anybody. We bent the leg on the tripod. Anyway, I walked over to the edge, and I looked down, and in a little defilade was I could see a soldier. So I stepped back and I said, "They're right down there." Oh, there's a nice, handsome young kid that was with us. His name was Johnny Keegan, out of Chicago. And he said, "I'll get him." Well, Johnny had picked up a machine gun on the beach, Thompson submachine gun. And he got up and he wanted to fire a shot down. He saw the guy too, and he wanted to fire a shot down, and his gun was on lock. So he stepped back, unlocked it. He had it on single fire, stepped back, went back, got a bullet right through his head, right through his helmet. He went down, and right near me, maybe a few yards, 3 feet away or something. But I took his helmet off, and I put my hand on the back of his head to get the helmet off, and my hand went into his head. I guess the bullet flattened out going through the helmet. And
right.
Took out the back of his head, and that was gone. It made me a little nauseated. I didn't throw up or anything, but it was kind of tough.
You know, Tony, I just pulled up the maps I have. So just so everybody knows the nature of the fight that Tony and 1st Battalion, 23rd Marines fought in, the turkey knob in the amphitheater, right, don't ultimately fall until D plus 19. So the Marines go ashore on February 19th. D plus 19 would have been March 10th, 11th, or something like that. That's how formidable the defense was in the sector that Tony's talking about. Tony, what do you tell me about sleeping at night? How did you sleep at night? I mean, you know, we all hear the stories of, you know, the flares going off and the Japanese moving at night. How did you sleep at night?
Well, we had foxholes and usually a little defilade, something to sleep in, but we didn't put on our pajamas. we'd do watches. I think if I remember right, it was like 2-hour watches, maybe three, and stay awake. And usually there was a couple of us, or maybe two or three, right around the area where we were, and do watches and stuff. And of course the Japs at nighttime would, for Corman, Corman, help, help. That was a Japanese way of trying to demoralize us and that sort of thing. And other than that, we'd stand watches and so on and so forth. And, you know, when you have to relieve yourself when you're in the field and so on and so forth, you just find a place where you can be a little discreet and pass water or waste whatever. When our K rations always came with a little toilet paper, if I recall.
Right.
And so on and so forth. So anyway, and I understood that, I'd heard anyway, that a lot of guys got hit passing a little waste with their pants down, so on and so forth. Probably a sniper or somebody. I don't know. But I heard that. I didn't see it happen. And it's logical that could happen.
My guest today is on a special edition of All Marine Radio. Always special when we get a chance to talk to Iwo Jima veterans. His name is Tony Kappa. He is a native of California, as I am, a member of the 1st Battalion, 23rd Infantry Regiment with the 4th Marine Division. So a privilege for us to have him on today and talk about his time on Iwo Jima. Talk to us about... You guys, as you continued to push north, Tony, how do you guys find out that, you know, do you guys push to the coast and pretty soon, you know, the fighting's all gone? Are you wounded at all? Are you medevaced? Did you stay with the battalion till the end of the fight?
I did. I was on the island 31 days, wow. Maybe 32, I don't know for sure. But, yeah, and I guess we were dates are the 36. Anyway, around the we were 36 days on the island of Marines, and I remember when we left the island. So I'd heard I didn't get involved in it, but the Japanese had enough soldiers to do a little counterattack one night, and the army, well, we turned the area, had turned the area over to the army, but we went back in and cleaned up the Japanese that were attacking.
They attacked down at airfield number one down on the southern end, right?
You know the history better than I do on some of those things.
Well, you know, the last organized resistance as units mopped up and they infiltrated down the other side of the island from you, and then attacked a series of tent compounds, and then Marines repelled them. How did when you left? Where did you guys go from there? Did you go to China? Where did you?
No, we were supposed to go to Okinawa, and we lost too many troops, and we had to go back to Maui to regroup. And that's what happened. We went, were we on an aircraft carrier? No, I came home on an aircraft carrier. Anyway, went back to Maui on an APA, I think it was. And after we were on Maui for another few months regrouping, and they dropped a big one in Japan, and the war was over, I was... I was there for, I guess, a couple of months after the war was over. Then they put me on a baby aircraft carrier along with a lot of other Marines and back to San Diego. And I was discharged right on the dock. got my severance pay, so on and so forth.
I don't know how I got back to it.
I don't remember, but I did.
You got discharged on the dock, so you come off down the.
Yeah.
Holy smokes! What? Let me ask you a question, Tony. So you just survived one of the most violent battles in the Marine Corps, right? 40,000 Marines and sailors above ground, 22,000 Japanese, mostly below ground. So you have 60,000 people, right? Thunderdome on an island that's 2 miles by 2 miles, if you kind of square it up, and no prisoners are taken. You just survived that thing somehow or other, right? As a grunt, for God's sakes, and you survived the whole battle. So, what was it like? You know, when you guys on the way back to Hawaii, did you talk about that very much, or did you just kind of move on?
No, not really. No, I remember back in camp we had a replacement. We were getting replacements back in our group and so on and so forth. And on Maui, on Iwo, you probably know this story. Japs had some kind of a mortar or something. They called them flying trash cans.
Right, spigot mortar.
You know about those.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they were going through the air. And some of the guys brought that back to Maui with them. And one of the new replacements, he picked it up and he's going, and he was doing it too much and it rattled me. And I guess now that we hear that fancy word that they use for depression or whatever, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, PTSD.
Yeah, that. I guess I had a touch of that and I attacked the guy and it didn't amount to anything, but I remember that now, and now that I hear those letters, I can think, well, I must have suffered a little bit of that at that time.
A little bit. So you come home, and then what happens? You get on with your life?
Yeah, well, when I was aboard ship going to Iwo, I got a Dear John from my little lady, and she enjoyed her release from marriage and our two boys. I had two children that I left behind. And so came back and had to regroup the family. My sister had taken one of my boys and my father had taken the other into his home, father and mother. So, here I am. You know, those problems exist and you live through them and carry on. So,
did you ever get remarried?
I did get remarried, and I had a marriage of 52 years. She died in 2000.
Attaboy. So let me ask you. So did the things, how did you deal with, I mean, it's not like you can just forget about the shit that happened to you on Iwo Jima, right? I mean, and you described the death of your friend in the fighting hole next to you like it happened this morning. And so those things never go away. All these years, you know, how did you deal with that stuff when it would bother you? Did you just try to stay busy? Because there was nothing called PTSD, right? I think, you know, people derogatorily called that kind of stuff, you know, battle fatigue. And it was not something that, you know, real men suffered from, even though most guys suffered from it. How did you deal with, you know, being in one of the most violent fights in Marine Corps history?
Well, I didn't feel I was dealing with anything, but as you talk, I'm thinking, well, I was busy. I had those two boys to take care of and so on and so forth. And yeah, I think being busy and keeping my mind off those things, but I don't know. I don't know how I think today how I feel about death. I lost my mother when I was 10, and I think about how much different my life would be if I had had a mother. But the Marines that died and the Marines that got killed next to me and so on and so forth. Why? Like Johnny Keegan, I remember him so well and whatnot, and I thought to myself, well, when I get home, I'm going to try to contact his family and let them know how he died and what happened. But never did that. Didn't know really just how to get his number, but I probably could have explored it. Today, you'd get on a computer like you do, and you probably know where Johnny Keegan was born. I know he was out of Chicago.
Well, you know what? I haven't done it yet, but I'll tell you what. I mean, it's going to take me about two. No, you're right. Today, you know, our lives are so much different. The way we're connected, and how easily and honestly, how we take that stuff for granted. Keegan John F. Corporal, killed in action, 23rd Marines. That's him, right?
Yeah.
What
did it say? What company? Was it G Company?
Let's see if I can find it now. Hold on, let me find it. They have the page that it sent me to, has all the Marines that were killed in action, and it's a pretty long list, as you know. The were you there for the dedication of the ceremony, Tony?
Is that the one that was going to on?
No. On the island before you guys left. I mean, they had built the 4th Division, 5th Division, and the 3rd Division. All had cemeteries on the island.
But yeah, I was there. I know the cemeteries you're talking. The cemetery you're talking about, and of course they were all white frosted. I guess they're all gone now. I think they brought the bodies back home eventually. But they did put crosses on. They didn't just put a flag or a mark or anything. They put crosses on the where they were buried. It was right close to Sarabachi.
Right at the base. They don't give a company. All they say is 23rd Marines. But he's the only Keegan. Killed on Iwo Jima. There are no other Keegans. K-E-E-G-A-N. Good Irish guy, John F.
Yeah, handsome kid.
Now, Larry told me that you didn't know about these Iwo Jima events that were taken that have been taking place at Pendleton, and this will be the first one you'll attend.
That's true. I didn't know about them, and of course, I've been in San Clemente 40 years now. I should have heard about them, but I didn't.
Have you stayed in touch with any of your friends from your time in the Marine Corps?
No, they were scattered. There was some of the young fellows that came in were out of Washington, and I stayed in touch with them a little bit. But most of them were passed away now and whatnot. So, yeah, I don't have any email contact, so to speak, with any of them, just memories.
Right. When you look back on your time, first of all, how do you explain, or do you explain, how do you explain how you survived? I would imagine there was literally millions of pieces of metal that flew by you, and were you ever wounded on the island?
Never was wounded, and I can't recall any metal, like an artillery shell or anything. And I heard them go off and so on and so forth, and I saw the tanks do their thing here and there. And I remember one of our members out of our platoon lost his head and went running across the open land there back towards – he was running towards Sarabachi, but – whatever, screaming, hysterical, and whatnot. I remember that story. And I knew his name at the time. But anyway, there were a few little incidents like that. And one day, I was going back to get our machine gun, to get the heavy, and I passed two guys, and there was one of them standing there. And he said, "Can you help me? What's the matter with this fellow here?" And he was standing there, and he said he can't move his mouth. And I thought, well, maybe I got by a bullet, and I was looking around to see a wound or something, and no wound. Well, he had that, they had something they called Thompson's disease or something that affects your, it's not Thompson's, it's something else, but it's a similar thing, and it's some kind of a thing that hits you, and you can't move your mouth or whatnot. Sometimes maybe it hits your arms, I don't know, but it's just something that from the inside out.
Right.
It wasn't from a wound or anything at all.
Interesting. But
after he got some help, he had to go back, I'm sure, to...
The if there before we finish up here, Tony, what if there's one thing about the Battle of Iwo Jima, I mean, that I haven't been smart enough to ask you about, what is it?
What is it you want me to tell you?
Well, no, I mean, I'm you know, is there something?
Do I have a question in my mind? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I mean, if there's one thing that's that I haven't asked you, right? That you want people to know about the Battle of Iwo Jima that I haven't been smart enough to ask you, what is that?
Well, I would say if you get into combat, keep your head down. Don't be a turkey and pick your head up and down and up and down. First thing you know, you'll get a bullet in it. Other than that, I can't think of anything that might help anybody survive a time in combat.
All right. What did can you talk about the Japanese soldier as a fighter? That was, you know, we talked about how ultimately in the vicinity of Turkey Knob and the amphitheater, it took. Armored bulldozers bulldozing roads, and then flame tanks coming up, and shooting flame into the apertures of the hillside of the amphitheater and Turkey Knob and all that stuff. The Japanese, so did you see them very often, or were they, they're often described as, they'd shoot at us, but we wouldn't see them, and then we'd seal them up and we'd blow up tunnels. Did you see the Japanese soldier very often?
I didn't. Maybe some of the guys that went into the amphitheater did, but chances are they were in their caves or whatever and just shooting out, and they didn't see them. They said that you might have this in your history book. The Germans counseled the Japanese prior to Iwo Jima, and they didn't do those bonsai attacks that they had done on the other islands and so on and so forth. They taught them more to be reclusive and to dig themselves in and so on and so forth. Did you hear that story?
Oh, well, I haven't heard that one. Everybody lays, most of the people that I've read, give credit to General Kuribashi, for that. I'd not heard that somehow or other the Germans had some input into that, but that was... them underneath the ground and exacting a huge toll, because you read before the battle, given the number of days of preparation and the way the Navy prepared it, in fact they even ended their preparation early and headed for Okinawa and saying that we've prepared that thing enough and you're going to go in there and you'll be there a few days and it'll be done. And lo and behold, how many days did you say you spent on there, Tony?
32 days.
32 days on that island. Yeah. Well, let me just tell you, Tony, first of all, I want to thank you for doing this. For those of the rest of us who've read about the heroism of you and your fellow Marines and sailors who've watched videotapes, looked at pictures and kind of stood in awe. I want you to know that, we've all been mindful of it when we've gone to Iraq and Afghanistan about it's our job to hold a long tradition, that's been written in blood by guys like you and your friends and Corporal Keegan. And I want you to know that we're pretty mindful of that when we go fight that we have a long tradition in the Marine Corps of guys who come and serve and fight, and I want you to know that we're pretty mindful of it, and I want to thank you for coming on and doing this today and sharing your story, and can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to meeting you here in a week or so.
Now that's a two-way street. I want to meet you also. Have you done some of the other islands like Saipan and Tarawa and so on?
Yeah, whenever I get a chance to meet World War II veterans, which isn't as often as I'd like, to be honest with you, because they're older and not everybody is has their wits about them like you do. And so whenever I get a chance to drag them on this radio show, I dragged their ass on, and I talked to them about all these things that we've talked about, you know, that because you know, Marines can't get enough of this stuff. And as you know, you were part of an iconic battle, and guys like you are revered and held up in the Marine Corps. And I know you're going to look at us and say, hey, look, I just did my job. I didn't do anything special. But that's certainly not the way we look at it.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, somebody, I'm giving you a quote, if you were there, I don't have to tell you. If you weren't there, I can't explain it.
Right.
And that's true to a point. A lot of the guys don't want to talk about it because it's hard to explain. I didn't get into a firefight with firing a machine gun at the enemy per se. We did overhead firing, and in the daytime we never got into a firefight that we needed to set up the light machine gun. So yeah, we've all had our own experiences and whatnot.
All right. But,
I learned a lot. I'm not sorry I went into the Marines. I learned how to tuck my shirt in and take the wrinkles out of it and wear the belt. When you tighten your belt, you get wrinkles. Pull them out. Don't walk around with your bunch of wrinkles in your shirt. Hygiene in general, when you don't have the facilities you have at home, and how to keep yourself clean and so on. So it wasn't all bad.
Let me ask you, as you get in the landing craft and head for the beach,
yes,
were you thinking about the guy who walked into the office at the recruiting station in Los Angeles and said, hey, you guys are now in the Marine Corps? Were you thinking, that son of a bitch?
No, not at all. I didn't feel that way. I felt, well, that's fine. And like you mentioned a little bit earlier, it was a job to do, and you did it the best you can. It was okay. And you know, the heroes are on the got a cross on their head.
Right. No, well, look, Tony, it's a privilege to meet you, and I look forward to hopefully having dinner with you in a couple weeks. And thank you very much for doing this.
Well, till then, happy trails to you.
Thank you, and happy birthday to you. I won't see you before your birthday, but happy 98th birthday.
Okay.
You're the first person I think I've ever said that to.
On his 98th.
Hey, Michael, let me cut in a minute.
Sure.
You know, he's going to be 98, but he's got an older sister living here in San Clemente as well.
Holy shit.
You can believe that.
Is she still nice to you, Tony?
Yeah, is she still nice to me? Yes, she's still nice to me.
Is she? Because you know, those Italian girls can get belligerent.
I'll tell her that when I see her, Mike. She'll be looking forward to meeting you.
Well, tell her. I'd be privileged. All right, guys. Thank you very much, Larry. Thanks, Tony.
Wish you well.
All right.
Enjoy Sunnies tonight.
I will. I promise you. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it. The All Warrior Radio Network.